Well, hey, friends. I'm Mark Grollo. Welcome to Wiki God Podcast, our stories shaping God in Toronto. And this is episode 36. Episode 36. This week we have a brand new guest. We're Wikiing God with Aaron Oxford, minister and director of a community called The Dale in Parkdale, Toronto. If you have never heard of The Dale, well, now you have. And you're in for a great couple of weeks. You're going to get to know this. You're going to get this fascinating cross-cut view of kind of the inner workings of a community, a group, a people that is diverse and hard to define and full of diversity, and they're doing such redemptive shalom bringing work to their neighborhood, to Parkdale, very local, all the stuff that I'm about. So I'm so jazzed by what they do and so amazed and humbled to meet Aaron Oxford. So yeah, that's going to be great. So that's coming up in just a few minutes. Just a few minutes. But before we get to that, I want you to consider as we get started here, two realities, two pieces. Okay, just a couple scenarios. Or just hold them in your head, your head hand. Hold them as separate ideas for a second. And then I want you to walk. Actually, then I will walk you through kind of how they might be connected, all right? Okay, so reality scenario one. Think for a second about excellent churches. Now, I don't mean list them. I don't mean list things you like about them. Just for a second, acknowledge that there are excellent churches and church communities out there, maybe in your neighborhood, maybe across your city, across town. Maybe you're attending one. But they exist. They exist. They are loved. And many people do not want to leave the church they love for something better, or because they're not 100% happy with every decision, or they're not 100% on board with everything about the style there, what have you. But they're a great church. So think the Meeting House, where I was a pastor for several years, and I know many people who listen to this attend. Think Spring Garden Church, where my wife and I attend on Sunday mornings here in Willowdale, North York. Or think Wine Before Breakfast, Brian J. Walsh. He and I have talked about that. It's been discussed on this podcast. Or The Dale, as you'll hear about in a few minutes. Or St. Paul's Anglican. Or all these churches, excellent communities of people doing indisputably great work and fostering growth in the lives of the people attending. Okay, so hold that in one hand. The first piece, the second piece over here. If and when a minister plants a church or starts something new, it's a generally understood best practice. And I heard this years ago, before this whole Wiki God, the altar project was even on my radar. Years ago, before I ever considered myself to ever be in this kind of position, it's generally best practice to say on the first or the second week to the new group attending on the brand new shiny church plan, essentially, you would say something like this. Hey, everyone, you know, we're thrilled that you came to check us out. Thanks for coming today. But if you're coming from another church, if you've been attending a church and calling a church home before tonight and it wasn't here, then please return to that church. And that's hard to do when you're looking out a new church plan. You got, oh, lots of bodies in the room. But you do this for a couple of reasons. One, it's gracious to other churches. So a new church in town is always going to generate some interest, particularly among people who are a bit unsatisfied with their current church. And so you'll get Christians checking you out, people who are unhappy at home, so to speak, to use that analogy. And they're peeking over the fence, kind of the church fence, to see if the grass is greener on this side. And the truth is, it almost always is greener at a new thing, right? Because the new thing hasn't hit the snag of conflict or disagreement or boredom breeding familiarity yet. That kind of thing. We can use We can use marriage analogies here. It's the honeymoon phase. A church plant is kind of a honeymoon phase for the first little while. And so it's so much more attractive. And so as a courtesy and as an acknowledgement to every other church in the neighborhood, especially well-established ones, it's best to say, hey, please don't be jumping on the new thing. Go home. Go home and work things out. So that's one reason. The second reason is, it's a kind of protective measure, actually, for the new church plant itself. You don't want to try to get a new church off the ground with a group made up entirely or 90% or even 50% of disgruntled, angry, burned out, disillusioned church people. It's just not a great way to get traction and feel the rhythm, you know? So let that be the second piece on the other hand. When starting a new church plant, it's best practice to say, hey, Christians from other churches, go home and work it out, because here, you know, we're trying to start out with a core and we're trying to galvanize a new group centered on community, us and what we're doing and our mission and that kind of thing. Okay, that's the preamble for this week. Now, I'm laying this out for you week by week, in a kind of real-time stream of consciousness, trail of breadcrumbs the last few weeks, that's just coming to me, kind of one piece at a time. I don't know where it's going, but I am very excited right now about something that I may be onto here, something that God may be walking us towards, and so I got to share it with you, and I'm kind of sharing it half-baked as I go for the last few weeks, particularly about the altar. And first of all, I'm excited about it, so I want to share it, and it's all I'm thinking about. But second of all, I want your feedback. I want you kind of involved in this process if you're tracking along. A couple hundred of you or so kind of listening every week very regularly. So now, bearing in mind everything I've said in the last few minutes, I want to share with you three kind of insights about the altar. The altar, what's the altar? Well, hopefully you've been tracking along. If you haven't, it's this kind of living room, back deck, physical iteration of church that we're going to be launching this fall. Okay? So first, three things, three insights. First of all, I'm pretty excited about all of these ahas for me. So first, the altar is in a position, I think, to be essentially in a non-compete posture with 99% of the churches in North York, if not all of Toronto. Now, so you may think it's crass. Maybe your first response to that was, well, that's pretty audacious. We'll get to that. You might think it's crass or maybe all too blunt to use the term non-compete when talking about churches. But let's face it, when one church opens up across the street from another church, there are going to be thoughts of, okay, how is this going to impact us? How is this going to impact our church? We may work together. We may share values and stuff. We might get in the community and do barbecues and serve the local nonprofits side by side. But at the end of the day, how many people, are our people going to leave us and go over there? Is their music going to be better? Is their preaching going to be better? Is their childcare going to be better? Are their programs going to be better? On and on. And as I think about it, and this is all getting kind of back end loaded as I read Michael Frost's book and I think about it. I almost feel like I think about it maybe more than he does. It's what I'm proposing about the altar, founding it entirely on Michael Frost's Bell's Challenge. And again, that's last week if you missed that. The Bell's Challenge is basically committing to live out a rhythm of blessing three people, eating with three people, reading something about Jesus, meditating, and journaling a little bit every week and coming together to talk about it. If this is what we do, and it's all that we do, if this is kind of what predicates our whole existence, then I think, and this is the audacious and maybe overly zealous part that I'm exploring, and again, I think it's on to something, so I'm going to lay it out there as a thesis, I'll admit, the altar could be the first or a first truly ecumenical church in the GTA, because it could be a church where people come and unabashedly talk about the churches they attend. They don't have to hide the fact or feel like they're two-timing or feel like they're one foot here, one foot there. The churches they call home, and we're not asking them to leave those churches. We don't feel like you have a divided loyalty at the altar. If you go to Agent Court Pentecostal or St. Paul's Anglican or the Meeting House or Spring Garden, as I would love to keep doing, if you're coming to the altar, and the altar is your DNA group, your kind of discipleship, nurture, and accountability group in a new life rhythm of mindful neighboring, as we're calling it, through the Bells Challenge. Because, and here's why I can say this, because chances are, if you go to one of those churches I named, your church is not calling you to that level of practice. Of course, they're calling you to those values and hoping you're cultivating that in your life. So I'm not pointing out a deficiency here. Every church wants this in people who attend. But the level of practice of saying, okay, I'm now committed to blessing three people, eating with three people, reading, journaling. So if the altar is offering something completely alternative and celebrates you in the church you're going to on Sundays and volunteering in midweek and financially contributing to, then the altar is kind of right in a pocket, so to speak. The altar is complementing your church experiences wherever they are, a Bible study, a home church, a Sunday morning worship. And we're not only never asking you to leave that church, but we're also supporting your adherence to it, supporting, enhancing, complementing whatever church you feel is a good fit for you. Okay, so now maybe you're thinking, sorry, Mark, it sounds like you said back there, financially contributing to, on the list of, if you're volunteering, if you're going on site, financially contributing to there. But that was a mistake, right? No, it wasn't a mistake. And that leads us to the second thing. I told you three things here. The second thing that occurred to me that makes the altar in a non-compete position with other churches, and this is always the sticky wicket when it comes to churches versus other churches, money. Money. Well, guess what? The altar will not be asking attendees for their money. What? What? Pardon? Yes, you heard that right. The altar will not be asking you for your money. Here's how I can say that. If we're a community centered around discipleship rhythms, a simple group worship experience of Eucharist, discussion around accountability, probably in triads, groups of threes, kind of small breakdown groups, and a good dinner together, then there is no need for me to get paid for that. Ever. And so this stems from actually my being convinced, to put it as Hugh Halter does in one of his books, I think it's Bivo or Flesh, or I read it somewhere, but Hugh Halter says it so well, making Christian consumers is expensive, making disciples is cheap. Now, please don't get your back up about the word consumers. I know the word consumers can be pejorative, consumer Christians. That's kind of why making Christian consumers is expensive. I'm not using that pejoratively. It doesn't have to be a pejorative word. Tyler Wake Stevenson and I talk about that a bit in our interview a few episodes ago. Consumer can just mean one who consumes, right? And we all need to consume to live. Whatever your feelings about consuming steak, if it's lettuce and carrots, if it's cotton for your clothes, whatever, we need to consume to live. So a lot of churches are actually set up to create programs and content and resources that we consume. Everything from websites to teaching series to whatever. In the positive sense, resources, content, and programs that we consume, and that costs money, right? This podcast costs money. It's content that you're consuming. But the altar will be a discipleship accountability model for people who want to voluntarily invite rhythm and practice and discipline into their existing spiritual life, whatever that is, church or no church. And so in that sense, you could keep financially supporting whatever enriching content is provided by your church and wherever else. And we at the altar could bless you in that. Now, I'm sure you have a lot of but what about questions, like, but what about stewardship, or what about ownership, or what about supporting a pastor? What about paying people to do important stuff for the group, the community? Okay, I hear that, but for the sake of time, I'm going to leave that and make that maybe a whole other episode. But suffice it to say right now, I'm looking at raising my own support. I'm looking at being bivocational, and I'm looking at setting up a model that depends on little to zero, as close to zero as possible, financial infusion. Obviously, I've got to pay the bills and feed my family somehow, but the group, in terms of what the community is, we're not a consuming group at the altar. So more than a few voluntary bucks maybe on the buffet to cover dinner every week, that would be about it. No paid staff. Making consumers is expensive. Making disciples is cheap. And I see the altar as being really a stripped-down, nuts-and-bolts, disciple-making, rhythm, in accountability group. So that's the second thing. And finally, this came to me lately, and it could be the most exciting one of all. As we've said, the altar can work for people connected to a church. So that's what we just said. The altar can work for people, of course, without a church, and for whom the altar would be their church. And so you got those kind of two people. But get this, I think the altar could also work for someone who is agnostic or even atheist. I've mentioned how I personally have no interest in, just personally, in a seeker-sensitive kind of community or model where we kind of dumb things down, or we mute or soften the Christianness of our gatherings for the sake of the new person, you know, stay away from confusing languages or strange rituals or whatever. You can check out other episodes to hear me talk about that. But it occurs to me recently, someone who has no confession of faith, who just would say, I do not adhere to the creeds at all, I don't, but, you know, I'm not buying into the divinity of Jesus. I'm not even sure about the resurrection thing. Okay. Someone who has none of that could still commit to the Bell's Challenge. Eating with three people, blessing three people, reading about Jesus, meditating and finding quiet and journaling. And they could do that and not feel alienated or estranged in a group that is also doing that. Because we'll be doing those things from each of our own trajectories and out of our own particular locations on the journey, and growing together and sharpening each other and nurturing each other week after week. So everybody will be in a different place in the room. If that's all the way to, I don't know, hyper-Orthodox, if that's a thing, or on the other hand, a new atheist. So if you're a Pentecostal coming out, and your atheist roommate wants to come along and says, hey, you know, I've noticed you doing this three people blessed, three people eating with thing, and I'd like to do that too, just for personal growth, read about Jesus and meditate. Well then, welcome. Welcome to the altar. Jump in. So in a nutshell, and in summary, all of a sudden I'm kind of getting this insight, this feeling, just to what extent, and unbeknownst to me until just this past week or so, just to what extent the altar will fit into kind of the original impetus for the WikiGod project. This deep yearning and desire that I feel, a place for people from all different churches and denominations, or no church and no denomination, to listen to each other, to be together, to learn and to share with each other the best that we have to offer each other and the best that we have to offer the world. And so going back to those two things off the top, the best practice of saying to the people at the new church plant, go home, we wouldn't have to do that at the altar. Because I would not say go home and go back to your church. I would say keep going to your own church. And I hope that this Rhythm of the Bells challenge enhances that, makes you an even better adherent to that community. And then the other thing that we mentioned, which was just excellent churches. They exist. Yes, they do. And so, again, we're not calling people away from them. We would say you can be going to a church or you could be calling the altar your home church, and let's all do that together and talk unabashedly about the great things happening in those congregations. I don't know. Is this pie in the sky? Do you have any thoughts or strong opinions on what I said above? And I guess, are you as excited as at the possibilities as I am? I think that's probably coming through. This is kind of a recent realization for me, and I'm just excited. I feel like this is bigger than me, and I don't know what's cooking here. So I'd love to hear from you. This could be one of the most exciting things I've ever hit on, or it could end up being a cautionary tale for years to come. You know, don't try what that guy did. I don't know. but I think we can do this. I'm excited at the possibilities. All right. I think a lot of this train of thought comes more and more to me as I get the privilege to get to know great churches and passionate leaders who I in no way want to compete with. I don't even want to like all offer an alternative. And Aaron Oxford and The Dale are just one example of that. What an important ministry The Dale is in Parkdale. What an inspiring leader Aaron is. And you're going to find that out. She was so generous with her time and with being vulnerable and really walking us through the inner workings of what it's like to serve a neighborhood at such depth as The Dale does. So get ready for this. 2 weeks of it. It could just change your life. Here she is, Aaron Oxford, pastor and director of The Dale. I think the levels are nice here. Good. And I'll introduce you before. I'll say whatever I want about you without you there. So it's ideal for me.
Yeah, that's the part I'm scared of. No, I'm kidding.
Aaron, what would you say The Dale is? What is it? It's one of those things, kind of like Sanctuary, when I was asking Greg Paul. These things are hard to define because when people say church, or when you say church to the average person, there's an idea in people's heads. And the more I've kind of researched The Dale, it kind of defies easy definition. So what would you say from the leader, from the pastor? First of all, I should probably ask you what you call yourself.
Well, we struggle to know what to call me, I think, but pastor and director.
Okay. Okay, pastor and director. So a spiritual and a administrative.
Yes,
title.
I definitely hold those two roles.
And you balance those? That happens?
Endeavor to.
Which one comes more naturally, would you say?
Oh, the pastoring.
Oh, yeah?
I have an affinity for administrative work.
Okay.
But I would struggle if it were all that I did.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely much more a people person. I want to be connected. I want to be in conversation. Yeah. More than I want to be behind a computer.
But you have an affinity for it. That must help.
I think it does.
Because I don't have an affinity for it. But you have to do it, right?
I have to do it.
Yeah.
And I have lots to learn, too. I mean, I'm not a perfect administrator by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay.
But I do enjoy it as well.
Mm. All right. So we're here with Aaron, pastor and director of Parkdale Neighborhood Church.
Formerly Parkdale Neighborhood
no
Church.
No way.
Now the Dale Ministries.
Okay, so it is the Dale Ministries.
It is the
so
Dale
anything
Ministries.
That I see that says like PNC or whatever, that's the old
It's
vernacular.
The old name.
Okay. I don't know if the Dale was just like an affectionate
no.
name. It's official now.
It's official. Okay. I mean, it's still becoming legal. But we are using it officially.
Illegally. You're using it illegally.
Well, you're using it illegally. That's right.
Okay.
Oh, dear. Yes. All it's right. our operating
okay,
name.
Okay, good. Hopefully yeah. no one legal listens to this. The board.
Yeah.
So that's good. So what would you say is the Dale? Back to that question. Now that we've established who you are.
The Dale Ministries is a community that seeks to place at its core those who often aren't. So people who are experiencing marginalization to varying degrees are placed at the core. It's not made up entirely of those who are close to the street or, you know, living in that kind of need.
And that's a good thing, right? That's something you would want.
Oh, I would like for it to be diverse. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want it to become a kind of ghetto.
No.
Because that gives us the separation that you're probably trying to get away from.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. But we do. So we are a community that would say we want to invite everybody there into full participation of it in the best way that they're able to.
Okay.
That we are journeying together alongside one another in our collective brokenness.
Yeah.
And that in doing so, we hope to become more whole in Christ.
Yeah. So that's beautiful. Who are the, you say the marginalized. That can be a very, I don't know.
Nebulous
intangible
term.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you define that? And what happens when a person who goes to the Dale, does somebody who goes to the Dale say, oh, I'm one of the marginalized ones? Like, how does that work in what you do?
Well, I'm hesitant to label anybody.
Yeah.
I've never liked the term the homeless, even, because I don't think that anybody classifies me as the housed.
right.
But I...
I never thought of that.
But I am... But I do want to recognize that there are people who really do live sort of on the outskirts of things. And usually in our context, that means that somebody is dealing with being underhoused in some way. So who might be living rough outside. A number of our people are also dealing with really significant addiction to substances. A number of our people are living on government assistance.
Okay.
And so maybe housed, but, you know, their whole check or the majority of their check might go to that housing. And so there's very little left over.
Right.
We have people who are refugees. We have people who are really displaced from their any kind of family, who have really experienced a great deal of hurt in their lives. And it's the kind of hurt that they're carrying is worn very close to the surface. And as a result, people make judgments quite often about them. People who aren't in the same kind of living in the same kind of circumstances. And so that's what I mean by marginalized.
Okay.
Is that those who have more tend to maybe even be scared of some of the people who are a huge part of the Dale.
Yeah. I'd like to maybe probe that idea a bit more, but that was such an excellent segue into people who are scared, like what you just said. How about you? Like, how did you get started on this journey? It takes a certain special kind of person to kind of step into this kind of work. It's not, I don't want to say it's not normal, but it's certainly not widespread. This kind of community or even Christians who kind of turn and step right into it like you have. So what were some of kind of your early experiences with this? Did you grow up around marginalization or in a community of that or just a volunteer thing? How did you get into it?
I didn't grow up in a marginalized way, particularly. I was born in Toronto. I was raised in North Toronto, which for most people would be considered a fairly affluent area of the city. But my parents did end up divorcing when I was quite young. And while my father was able to continue to support us in the way that I think he best understood how, which was financially, I was still, my brother and I were primarily raised by our mother as a single parent. She made some difficult decisions along the way that were really necessary. So for instance, she left her job for a full year, more than a year probably, to homeschool my brother, who was struggling at the time. And the only way that she was able to do that was because we did have a church community around us who was willing to fill in the gaps. And so that was very formative for me to be in a situation where we needed people to be there for us, and we also needed to be willing to let them be there for us in that way.
So like experiencing what dependency is like in a way?
I think so. And I think I understand that more now looking back on it. As a young person, I don't know that I always understood it that way. But it was important for me. And then I always thought that I would pursue music, and I was all set to go into musical theater. And
so that means a lot of that was going on in your teens.
Singing
and dancing on stage.
Exactly. Yes. Jazz hands.
Nice.
Lots of jazz hands. And
she's doing them right now for those of you who can't see.
That's right. But something ended up not sitting right about that. Though I was I had gotten into a program to study it, was all set to go the summer before I was set to go.
Was this like university?
This was university.
Oh, okay. So you really pursued it.
I really did. And I was working in it for a time too. Something didn't sit right and I couldn't quite name that, but I went to visit a friend who was attending Bible college, and I walked into the building, and maybe it sounds strange, but it was almost as though I immediately knew that I needed to be there instead.
Wow.
And
it's a strange, like, I know the feeling you're talking about, and isn't it so comforting, but at the same time shattering? Because you're just like,
completely disconcerting. This was turning everything upside down for me.
It feels so right. And then like, it's also a horrible realization at the same time.
That's right. So I did end up going to Bible college that fall instead of
very sudden.
To university for musical theater.
And people in your life were thinking, were you getting affirmed in that, or were you getting?
I was getting
what
affirmed.
Are you doing?
There were definitely people who wondered what the heck was going on.
Yeah,
absolutely. My dad being one of them.
Okay.
But I also felt mostly like people understood this decision of mine and that they were trusting that I was doing something that I felt I should. And it was during that time that I got more introduced to the street. There were a number of people who ended up becoming mentors for me. I was who had significant experience doing the kind of work that I'm now doing.
Okay.
And I think my love of people was always there, and then suddenly I found this wonderful outlet for that. And I don't really know how to describe it except to say that I was immediately comfortable with people who were somehow connected to street life. And
so there was
it took off from there.
There was a group at
I went to Tyndale, it was Ontario Bible College at the time. Yeah, there were a group of people who were going out every week and doing, at the time, what we called sandwich runs. And so we were making bag lunches, and we were connecting with people on the street. The bagged lunch, I think, was important. It helped people eat when they needed to, but it was more almost an opening, a way for us to engage with people. And over time, because it was so consistent that we were out, the people that we were meeting were becoming our friends. And I didn't want to leave.
Yeah. You've quoted about what you do at the Dale. It's not uncommon for me to be huddled with people from the Dale in a corner, at a table, or on a bench, just like I was with a friend. Bystanders will occasionally quietly ask, what are you doing? You must be helping that person, right? And I usually respond, we're helping each other. And you also quote somewhere on a blog that you wrote, I just finished telling some people this afternoon that the Dale pours more into me than I will probably ever pour into it. When did that start happening? Did that happen quickly? Like on a sandwich run, did you feel some of that kind of middle class fear and angst that, you know, a sandwich run, oh my gosh, here's a homeless person, very volatile. It's very common for people to feel that kind of apprehension when they start that. Did you feel that? And how did you get from there to now, believing that and feeling that these people are your friends? And
I honestly didn't feel too much apprehension.
Okay, so you never did. So there's no
hope
for those of us who do.
Well, I can't say that I never... No, of course not. I can't say that I never felt some apprehension. And there were certainly times when I was aware of feeling uncomfortable and maybe in a... I recognized that I was putting myself into a place where I could potentially be unsafe.
Yeah, okay,
Those feelings did happen in me, but they never were so big that it meant I didn't want to go into it.
Okay.
And I think, yes, right away, I struggled as a teenager, sometimes continue to struggle with anxiety that's very internal. I think it, when you boil it down, it means that I'm still learning how to trust. I was coming out of this home that had become broken itself. I had this fear of people leaving me, of relationships ending.
Yep.
And suddenly I was talking to people who maybe didn't have that same experience, but could say, I know what it feels like to be messed up. And here are the ways that I messed up. And there were so few masks.
Right.
On those sandwich runs. It felt very stripped down, and I think I found it, rather than scary, actually quite refreshing. And not because I'd had tons of experience in churches where people weren't endeavoring to be themselves, but I think overall the culture of church is one where we don't always feel free.
Right.
To talk about those hard things, that we want to show how we're striving to be better and more holy and all of those things. And here were these people that weren't scared to say the ways in which they were struggling. They were willing to confess before God things that I struggled to confess out loud. And I immediately felt like I was being taught something.
Wow. It is a church thing. It's also kind of a culture at large thing.
Yes.
Almost like a result of consumerism. That sense of having to put a self forward, having to put a self on, I guess, kind of what you're saying. Where when you're marginalized, it's kind of out there for everyone to see, I suppose.
Yeah, you can't help but show it in a way, right? And I think we can learn from that.
And you certainly blog very openly and honestly. I'm going to link to your blog in the show notes so everyone can start reading what you put out there. But yeah, I get that sense. You talk very frankly about being in therapy or going to therapy, and as a husband of a therapist, I love that you're breaking that stigma down. I talk about my stints in therapy and talking. And again, when you lower the mask, whether it's on the street or with a therapist, something happens. Makes you wonder why we wear the masks so often.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I notice something that happens immediately with somebody. If I don't know somebody well, but I'm willing to immediately respond to the regular question that we ask everybody, how are you? By instead of just saying the typical response, which is I'm fine or okay. Not that I need to bleed out everything that's going on in me, but if I'm able to say, well, actually today today is okay in some ways.
Yeah.
And I'm struggling a little bit today. That immediately the wall that quite often exists between people sort of comes down. I think people are hungry for something that is more transparent and authentic.
In that moment, I kind of cynically, somebody says to you, how are you? And I just say, do you want the church lobby answer or do you want the real answer?
That sense exactly.
Of like, on Sunday morning, service is about to start or service is just ending and there's just, how are you? Oh, I'm good. And everyone is fine and good? Really?
There's no
way.
We
all tell each other we are. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, that sense of, do you want to be honest and real about it? But then it's going to take a few minutes.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe we really do have a few minutes to talk.
Maybe that's what really is the issue. Is time is such a precious commodity. And if I tell you things are not great, well, you either have to probe more deeply or run away, which
that's
is awkward.
Right. Yeah. And maybe it's scary for all of us to let down our guard that way. I think we all fear being rejected. I fear that it will be too much for people to handle.
Yeah.
And my life isn't just hard either. Like, I want to be able to share with people both the good and the challenging. Yeah. I want to get to a place in relationship where we can celebrate together too. But getting to that place in relationship requires a little bit of work and being open.
This might be related to this conversation or not. I sense a possible overlap. On Wednesday nights, again, I'm getting this from a blog. On Wednesday night, you wrote, as we do every week, a group of us wandered around Parkdale.
Yes.
So on Wednesday nights, as you do every week, does this happen? You wander around Parkdale? And is it that? It's just kind of a neighborhood walk?
It is truly that.
To get into conversations or...
Yes. So we meet at one of the buildings that shares space with us now. We just use it as our meeting spot. We leave at 8 o'clock. The numbers vary.
Okay.
But we always have a little critical mass of people that walk. We pray. And usually our prayer is that we would have our eyes open and our hearts open and our ears open to whatever and whoever it is that God might have us engage with on that evening. That we would know when to be quiet, that we would know when to not pursue conversation, because that happens too.
Yeah.
And then we walk our neighborhood. We stop when we encounter somebody. We go into coffee shops. We inevitably end up at Tim Hortons. And it's... Also, one of the things that I also really love now about Wednesday nights is that people from our community are participating in that as well. So we're quite a motley crew walking through Parkdale at night. But it's amazing what can happen when we do that. And it makes us feel very connected to the neighborhood. When I talk about spilling into the streets as a way that we are now, this is part of it, is that we spend a great deal of time outside connecting with people exactly where they're at.
Huh. Yeah. So is it becoming kind of a Parkdale institution to see this crew walking as a group on Wednesday nights?
I think so.
It's like there they are again.
Yeah, there's that Dale crew. I hear people say that. Yes, I would say it is happening. Huh. And I've been struck recently, too, but I took somebody into a little hole-in-the-wall coffee shop on Queen Street that I actually don't frequent very much with somebody who is... her presence is known in the neighborhood. She's really struggling with mental health issues, and you can see, and I feel sad about this, the sort of fear that does exist whenever she's present. And I went in and explained to the person that I was there to buy my friend and myself a coffee and a donut. We'd be sitting, and he said, "That's fine. I know who you are." And I said, what do you mean you know who I am? And he proceeded to describe to me the Dale. He knew me by name. And this was somebody I'd never met. But I think he's an example of the way that the neighborhood is starting to understand our presence.
I'm just curious, how did he describe the Dale? That was my question to you off the top. What is it from kind of an outsider's perspective?
He said that we were a church. He said that we feed the community. He said that we're present. He knew me by name. He knew my coworker. And he seemed to want to articulate that he trusted us as a result.
Yeah. Huh.
In some way that he was trusting us.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can kind of skip back to, in light of that, what's kind of the rhythm of the Dale community? So you got your Wednesday night walks. He said you feed the community. You're known for that, apparently.
Apparently.
So when does that happen? What's kind of a typical week? Or month.
Yeah, a typical week is that we have our largest scale drop-in happens on Monday. We're there from 10 until 3, and it's housed by a Presbyterian church in the neighborhood who agreed to house it when we lost our old space. So we have about between 100 to 120 people who come to that, and we have a meal. The food... in large part, is provided to us by Second Harvest. We're a Second Harvest agency.
Okay.
And it's an interesting way to cook because what happens is we get a Second Harvest delivery on the Sunday and we decide what we're going to make based on what we get.
So it's not all the fixings for a spaghetti dinner. It's a bit more eclectic than that?
It's very eclectic. Okay. And fortunately, we have a volunteer kitchen coordinator who's very good at... Okay. being creative with food and making it healthy and tasty and all those things. I think important about the Monday drop-in too is that the kitchen, the people who are working to make the meal, the people who are setting up the room, the people who are cleaning up after are all community members. And so it really is a meal for the community by the community.
Okay.
So that's Mondays.
That's Mondays.
That's just Monday. Yeah. On Tuesdays, my coworker Joanna and I have a staff meeting in a coffee shop.
Okay.
I carry my office basically in my bag to that. On Tuesday afternoons, we have a smaller scale, very conversational drop-in at the back of the Salvation Army thrift store in what they call their coffee corner.
Okay.
And it sounds like it wouldn't work, but it... does. It's a little space where they keep their books, and there's some couches and chairs, a sink, a coffee maker, and we inhabit the space for an afternoon.
Anything intentional happen there, or just hanging out, chatting?
We're intentionally hanging out and chatting.
Okay. But the conversation isn't led in a certain direction necessarily? Not like a study or a support group?
It is
explicitly.
Not.
Explicitly, okay.
I mean, those things, not explicitly.
Yeah, yeah.
All of those things sometimes end up happening, but it's very much guided by where people are at for the day.
Yeah, okay.
On Tuesday evenings at 7 o'clock, we have a Bible study at the St. Clair Center, which is a part of... a fixture on Queen Street called St. Francis Table. They share space with us now. We're working through the Gospel of Matthew.
I'm trying to pin on a mental bulletin board all the places you've named.
I know it's
hard.
And
it's only Tuesday.
It's only Tuesday.
But you've named like five different places. Okay. Well, I'll put a pin in that.
Next pin.
Yeah.
Wednesday mornings, we are at... 201 Cowan Avenue, which is a space inhabited by the Jeremiah community.
Okay.
And they have been kind to share that space with us. We have a breakfast and we make art supplies available and people can self-direct their work.
Okay.
There's usually music happening.
I saw on your website $75 is a donation that you
that's
would
right.
appreciate because that would replenish all the art supplies. So that's the kind of activity that that is.
Yeah, and there are people who might come and simply sit in a chair and read a paper. Huh. But we do want to provide a way for people to find their voice using the arts there.
You have like a, is that kind of led and guided by yourself? Or is there like a fine arts person, volunteer, who kind of thrives on that?
We have had in the past. We've had students from, or graduates from the Ontario College of Art and Design come and animate workshops for us about things like relief printing or painting, various things.
Yeah.
Currently, it's very self-directed. So we put out a bunch of supplies and people can use them as they like. Mm. What we are discovering is that people really are interested in having some direction, being taught a skill. And so we're looking at doing that again, having artists in.
Right.
So that's a hope and a dream.
Yeah.
That might come to fruition.
Yeah, lots of hopes and dreams. And I love that. You have visions and some of them will get seen through. Some of them will be fulfilled. And
yeah, we fumble our way through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's Wednesday morning. Wednesday afternoon is quite often filled with pastoral care type things. So we will accompany people to court dates.
Hmm.
We will visit people in jail, in hospital, in their homes, outside, on the street. Accompany people to appointments, various things like that. Hmm. Wednesday nights, as we've already talked about, we're wandering the neighborhood. And then the next time we're back together is on the Sunday afternoon at 2 for our worship service. And that's, again, at 201 Cowan Avenue.
Okay. One of the articles that I read about the Dale, this is another quote from you. It said, "We don't function as a traditional church." I think we've established that from what you've said already. "In the way that people think of a church, you say we do have a time that we gather on Sunday, but fundamentally we're just trying to be a safe and respectful community for everyone while particularly valuing people who are vulnerable." So, I mean, in that quote, you seem to want to pull the focus a little bit away from the Sunday thing. You know, we're not a traditional church. We do meet on Sunday, but, and then you immediately go to kind of the other things.
Yeah.
And I'm asking you this as somebody who's interested in just models of church and what do I want to do? And so kind of full disclosure, not just to make conversation here, but what have you found is important about that Sunday gathering? What does it look like? And how does it relate to the other activities of the week? Mm-hmm. And I guess giving you time to think, I'll just continue to drone on, but those two things can become very bifurcated, very separate. A church that is all about Sunday, most of what people do is on Sunday, or other churches or even agencies that do a lot of help in the community and don't see a role really for a gathered time of worship, whatever that worship looks like. I don't like to compartmentalized worship, period. I mean, feeding the people in the drop-in can be worship, but that hour of musical worship or reading worship or meditation worship, how do you see an interplay there, and why is that Sunday gathering important to the Dale?
I do want to say that the Sunday gathering is really important to the Dale, and I don't want to de-emphasize or make it unimportant as much as I want to emphasize or highlight the fact that a church is about not singularly the Sunday experience.
To put it in context, I think this quote, you were talking to a reporter who, I think you're aware of kind of the audience or the readership.
That's right.
You wanted to highlight that this is not what one might expect. So,
yeah, and that's long been the challenge for us, is in the way that we describe who we are. We want to say that we are a faith community, but so many people define church in this one way, and so our worship time with people is quite special. I think increasingly people are recognizing that it is truly a time set apart for this specific purpose, which is to sing and to read and to pray and learn and work through how we're feeling about all of that. We stress that we want it to be a space where people can truly come as they are. Mm. Now, that's messy. Mm. And I'm not sitting here claiming that it's easy.
Oh, that's messy. Not easy. I know that feels a bit like a cliffhanger ending. But at this point in the conversation, Aaron really goes into depth about what messy church, what hard church, what relationships look like, what we look like. Feels a lot like us, doesn't it? So part two, you can look forward to that. Aaron's going to describe a little bit more about messy church, more of her thoughts on faith and God and community and all that good stuff. So catch that next week. In the meantime, head over to the show notes now. Check out the Dale Ministries website and just kind of get the full detailed lowdown of all the amazing stuff they do. Check out Aaron's writings on her WordPress blog. I've got both those linked up right there. How can you reach out to me, connect with me, get a hold of WikiGod Podcast this week? As so many of you are doing, thanks a lot for David for your encouraging comment on episode 30. Right there on the website, www.wikigodpod.com. You can do that. I get that directly. I read it. I always respond. Thanks to David for doing that. That was encouraging. And thanks to Alice this week for phoning me up and letting me know how much episode 33 spoke to you. That was encouraging. So I love your feedback. I love your questions, your thoughts. Head over to the website, wikigodpod.com. Leave me a voicemail. Send me a direct email. Sign up for the mailing list as we talk more concretely about the altar and meeting times, when we're going to be doing what. I'd love to hear from you about what you heard today. Those of you who are wiser or more wizened or however you want to say it. What are your thoughts on the altar? Are we on to something here? Are we going to do this? Are we going to do this? So, at WikiGodPod on Twitter, WikiGodPodcast on Facebook, the website, drop me an email. I think you're getting the picture. This week, can we catch the vision of churches being truly non-compete, of really championing each other's work? And I think we can do it. I think we can do it at the altar anyway. We'll talk more. Next week, more Aaron Oxford. Look forward to that. Have a good one.